The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Founded in 2017 by Sean Baxter, George Georgiadis and Tim Boast, Never Never is undoubtedly one of the hottest distilleries in Australia at the moment. The company was recently named Champion Australian Distiller for the second year running at the 2021 Australian Distilled Spirits Awards, as well as being a finalist alongside Four Pillars for the IWSC's International Gin Producer Trophy. And there's been yet more accolades that you'll hear about in today's episode as we meet co-founder Sean Baxter. Unlike other Australian gin distillers that have defined themselves based on our native botanicals, Never Never has made its name on excelling at gins that are very classically styled. Today, Sean shares with you the benefits and challenges of this approach. We also discuss the thorny issue of base spirit and some of Never Never's innovative products like Ginache, made using Grenache grapes from its home of McLaren Vale in South Australia, and also its new oyster shell gin. That's all coming up after I ask Sean about the significance of the Champion Distiller Gong that Never Never took home for a second time last week.
Look, it's probably one of the biggest competitions here in Australia, not only because of how it is received across every other producer, all the other brands really respond and respect the competition. It's judged by over 40 of our peers. And that in itself, I think, separates it from a lot of other competitions in the market, and it's just a great way to round out the year. It's a wonderful accolade to be able to pick up Champion Distiller, but to also pick up Best in Class for the London Dry Gin and Navy Strength Gin for our Triple Juniper and Juniper Fruit respectively is also an amazing honour in such a competitive and very, very cluttered sort of gin market at the moment.
And also you received some international recognition as well with the IWSC International Gin Producer of the Year, getting shortlisted for that prize, which is no mean feat either.
Yeah, it's huge. It was really big for us. You know, like we're still a small brand, and to be up against brands like Four Pillars and Herno, you know, like they're big global brands with a huge reputation, and to just be mentioned in the same breath of those guys is a huge honour. And of course, Not winning it. Kyoto won it with their Kenobi gin, which is, again, a smashing, delicious, delicious representation of the Japanese gin market. But just to be there and thereabouts for us is huge.
And some individual accolades for Tim, your distiller, as well.
Oh, he'll love that you brought that up, mate. Absolutely. Tim won Distiller of the Year, Global Distiller of the Year, actually, at the Spirit Business Awards held in London. Just a couple of weeks ago. So a huge accolade for him. It's actually the second time that he's won it in 3 years. So pretty huge for him personally, and well-deserved. He sacrifices a lot to create the products that we make, and I'm sure he enjoys the attention.
How do you win that award?
It basically comes down to being nominated and effectively the impact that you make within your designated field. It is judged on paper, so to speak. So obviously racks up quite well when you've won the amount of gold medals and trophies that he's managed to pull off over the last 12 months. But, yeah, it's a huge honour for him to be able to be put in that kind of top echelon of producers across the world.
Mate, maybe we just sort of go back a little bit in the Never Never story. It seems to me like you guys made, you know, very definitely chose to go sort of very much down the classic path, and I guess that's been borne out with your most recent gongs last week, Best in London Dry and Best in the Navy Strength, two sort of classic categories. Tell me how that sort of transpired with you and your co-founders. Was it a case of that's just what excites you about gin is more the sort of classic styles?
I think it was born out from the start when we all sat down and went, well, if we're going to fail, at least we'll have like 10,000 litres of gin that we want to drink, right? So classic gin has always been a passion of all three of us. It's the way that we all discovered the market. It's the way that we enjoy drinking. When I was a bartender, when I used to work in venues around Australia, it was always the style of gin that I saw being ordered the most, being used in martinis, used in Negronis, used in classic gin and tonics the most. And again, we wanted to create a style that was a reflection, you know, of that juniper-forward classic London Dry character. And the main reason for that is that there is a science behind why it works so well. You know, juniper-forward gin styles make great gin and tonics, and they stand up cleanly and beautifully, you know, against a wide range of different mixes, of different modifiers like sweet vermouth or Campari. And it's something that people can understand quite easily, and that for us was one of the most important things. We wanted to create a gin style that was almost like an upgrade, was almost like a step up from the way that people traditionally purchased gin and traditionally purchased here in Australia imported gin. That's still one of the most popular, you know, varieties of gin on the shelf. So we wanted to be a local option that was still almost like a nostalgic connection towards flavours that a lot of consumers understood and drink regularly.
Did you have any concerns or reservations about how we're going to stand out when we're not going down the path of using weird and wonderful Australian botanicals to kind of set ourselves apart?
It's without question, it was our number one concern. And we knew from the outset that we had to create something that was a bigger, bolder, more intense representation of anything else on the shelf. And that was where we really tried to separate ourselves by creating what was effectively the triple juniper process, this way of amplifying and concentrating botanical character in our gin styles. What it does is it creates a wonderful separation from us and everything else on the shelf. And by dialing it up, by turning up those intense flavors through steeping, through pot distillation and vapor distillation, the result is a gin that is far, far richer and far more intense than a lot of the other gins on shelf, especially those that we're competing with from an international perspective.
How unique is it to be using those three different practices in production of your gin?
We are one of the first, certainly in Australia, to do it. Sipsmith do it with their VJOP, which is their very juniper representation. Ours is a little bit different. Sipsmith and their famous copper balls that hang in the actual still itself. Our vapor basket's actually disconnected from our pot still. And that is really important because what it enables us to do is actually disengage it, turn it off when we want to. That is actually what keeps the freshness and the brightness of the citrus character that our gin is well known for. That gives us the most amount of flexibility to make sure that we always have that kind of wonderful aromatic available. If we weren't able to turn it off, what would happen is sometimes those flavours can marmalise, they can start to cook out a little bit, and that's not what we want. We always want the brightness and freshness of that citrus. So here in Australia, I don't know, I'm sure there'd be a few people that are doing it this way now because we're quite open about the way that we do it. And it results in a very, very classic, very, very complex gin style that makes, cracking gin and tonics.
And vapor distillation is gathering a bit of momentum here. There's a few distilleries that are using that now.
Absolutely. It's been a part of distillation ever since, you know, when Hendrick sort of started sort of talking about its importance. Even before that, it was still very prominent. I think the main reason you're seeing such a huge focus on it here in Australia is that we have a lot of herbaceous sort of botanicals that can really suffer if you overcook them, if you put them into the pot. A vapor basket gives you much more control over the temperature, over the impact of that distillation methodology. It just allows you to be a bit more gentle with it. So I think that's why you're seeing a lot of it here in Australia from a vapor distillation perspective. It enables us to, really control the way we can extract flavor from myrtles and, from a variety of the other gum and other sort of leafy sort of botanicals that we tend to use down here.
With juniper rightly being such a focus for Never Never's gins, is there anything that you guys kind of do differently in terms of sourcing and the relationships you have with your suppliers? Because One thing I'm hearing a little bit about these days is that there is a bit of a shortage of juniper and it can be hard to get your hands on stuff.
Hopefully that wasn't just off the back of that April Fool's Day article.
I'd actually forgotten about that. We'll have to link to that from the show notes of the episode.
Definitely. Yeah. For example, right, I did that as a joke, as a bit of fun, put that out there, and the guys at bars and clubs ran it, and they understood it was a joke as well. They thought it was funny. But I've never had more negative feedback in my entire life in terms of people getting in touch with me, because it's a real fear. I just found it funny that people thought that Juniper Freak had more juniper in it than the entirety of Tanqueray. But that's fine. I won't mention who they are, but I had some very, very well-learned people who should know better that got in touch with me and felt a bit silly after I asked them what day it was. But yeah, it's definitely a real concern, but I don't think it's a concern yet for the immediate future, because you do have a lot of practices and safeguards in place to ensure that, you know, there isn't over-harvesting, that the people that are actually looking after the way that, you know, it's collected and then distributed. You've certainly got vested interests across the entire category. So it's not just gin makers, obviously. It's also the commodity brokers. It's also the farmers. Everyone's invested in making sure that they can continue to manage the efficiencies of the crop. So whilst there is definitely pressures on it, and you are starting to see, you know, varying levels of those pressures starting to come through in stock quality, I do think that we're not going to be in a position where there's going to be, a run on juniper to the point where we're going to run out. Like, that's just not something that I foresee happening in the short term. The other thing that's going quite well for us...
And if it does, it won't be Never Never that causes it.
It certainly won't be us, right? We're still only ordering by the ton, right? We're not ordering by containers yet. So I think there's a lot of other people in front of us that might have to manage their juniper, their juniper in different ways. But, there's also a huge amount of innovation that's occurring, you know, in the gin category as well. Even when it comes to what we've done in terms of steeping, macerating, pot distillation and then vapor distillation, that whole process is involved. It's not only just amplifying flavor, but also getting the most out of the juniper as well by actually applying all these different methods to it. So we are trying to make sure that we are using the juniper as many different ways as possible to extract as much flavor. That's kind of the interesting thing too. You know, you can get so many different reflections of juniper character into a gin in a lot of different ways. I don't think it's panic stations just yet, but it's still something to be mindful of. And especially when we're a brand that uses a lot of juniper, well, we do focus on that as our key botanical, as I think most gins should. But it's okay if other gins don't. More juniper for us, that's okay.
One thing we've spoken about a little bit on this podcast recently is Bay Spirit, which is not something that gets talked about a whole lot. Being a South Australian distillery, would I be right in saying that you're using a grape base down there?
No, we're not. We thought we would be. You're right. I'm glad that this question came up, because it does get a lot of, you know, of course, people that make their own Bay Spirit are going to champion the fact that they make their own Bay Spirit. And then that's totally fine. And I think that people that have the capacity and a still that's big enough to create enough neutrality in their distillate to be able to make gin, I think that you're definitely a skilled distiller, and I think that's worth celebrating as well. We're going to use grape, but we did some trials with grape, and we ended up not being particularly happy with, I guess, the comparison to what we were able to achieve with grain, and that's purely from a textural perspective. We were making a gin style that is a huge, you know, celebration of juniper character, of a London dry style. There's not a huge amount of London dry styles knocking around the UK with a grape-based distillate. You know, again, it's not something that is traditionally found that much in those styles. And we just found that when we started making martinis with it, when we started breaking it down into the kind of gin serves that we wanted to actually create, we found that the grain base was superior. So we use Manildra, same as Four Pillars, same as, you know, Archie Rose, same as a huge amount of different distilleries in Australia. And I think it's off the back of that very, very clean and very, very neutral spirit base that we're able to create the real artistry of our botanical makeup. And it's with that neutrality that we're able to really express exactly how spectacular our recipes can be. And off the back of that, we've won some incredible awards. So I think there's definitely a need, I think, to have that neutrality, and it gives us the very best opportunity to create, award-winning gin.
This is where you can maybe help me out here with an explanation. So when people talk about neutral spirit, the layperson would sort of assume that that would essentially mean that you're distilling down to a point where it wouldn't really matter what the sugar source is, whether it's grape or grain. But even at that high neutrality, you're still talking about two different products that have, albeit subtle, textural differences.
It's really interesting, right, James? Like when you taste high proof, when you taste it at high proof, you can't pick it up, right? When it's at a really, really high ABV, the texture of the alcohol just overwhelms. But when you start to take those spirits down by using the same water source that you're going to use. If I gave you a taste of a grape spirit and then a cane spirit or a sugar-based spirit, as you mentioned, or a wheat-based spirit, even different grains like corn, you would be able to pick up variation. You might not be able to pick which one's which, but you'll definitely go, that tastes more fruity. That tastes really clean. That one tastes quite nutty. Like as you bring those ABVs down, you can definitely pick up flavor. And of course, when you're making drinks, you're diluting the whole way through, So again, it just comes down to personal preference. Like I do think that there's a lot of skill in a lot of, there's some incredible distillers out there that are turning and transforming their neutral, like a produce on their farms, whether it be wheat, whether it be grape, they're actually making their own wash. They're then, turning that into a spirit and manufacturing either, gin, or they're on their way to whiskey as well in some cases. I think there's a massive skill set to it, but every single one of those distillers would agree there's a lot of flavour in it. There's a lot of intensity of the grain, the raw material, and you have to build your gin into a product that is able to incorporate those flavours and works well with those flavours. And that's just the nuts and bolts of it. So I think if we wanted to create a product like that, we would have to have a very specific kind of end product in mind. And for us, we wanted to make a gin and tonic or a martini that rivals the kind of gin and tonics and martinis that imported products make, and we do it better than they do. So at the moment, we're competing with those brands, and to do that, we need to have a very, very neutral spirit base to be able to achieve that.
Now, I was really interested in the product that you brought out recently, the Geneva, or maybe I'm not pronouncing that how I should, but you did use a different spirit base for that. So maybe tell me how that came about. And you worked with a lesser known distillery from Tasmania for that one, I believe.
just one of those little ones, Sullivan's Co. So we called it Jennifer because we can't call it Geneva here in Australia because it's has appellation. To make Geneva, it has to be within not only the Netherlands, but also there's a couple of different parts of or regions around the Netherlands that also can make Geneva. Australia is definitely not one of them. So we had to be a bit cheeky about it and called it Jennifer instead. What Jennifer effectively is it's the granddaddy of gin. It still exists. It's still made and consumed quite happily in the Netherlands. But it is traditionally a style that is far more malt spirit forward. This is traditionally made with malt wine and contains a small amount of sugar as well. So it's a very, very rich, quite robust palate weight. It not only uses multitudes of different grains, so you might find wheat, corn, rye, a multitude of different styles that are in there. And then it's flavoured using botanicals, so similarly done to the way that you make a gin. It's consumed quite differently as well. It never really sort of found its way into cocktail culture. It's still quite an antiquated style. There are some drinks out there that work quite well. The original Tom Collins was based off Geneva. So again, works quite well in that respect. And when you think about that, obviously, it's basically a highball. The way that you sort of consider a whiskey highball with a little bit of soda and a slice of lemon. You're not too far away from what you might be going down in terms of this particular style of spirit. But it was a bit of fun. It was the first time that two Australian brands that had won their respective categories at the World Spirit Awards. Sullivan's Cove won World's Best Single Malt Whiskey in 2014. We won World's Best Classic Gin in 2019. We thought it would be a bit of fun to combine the spirit base that made that product award-winning with our botanical recipe that made the Southern Strength so revered and so special. And yeah, we ran into a few hiccups along the way. You can't just sort of sub one in and expect it to work. There was definitely some tinkering to make sure that the botanical profile worked in that spirit base. But it makes an incredible, you know, quite unique hybrid spirit style. It's not quite a Jennifer. It doesn't have the same palate weight. It's not as heavy. Jennifers tend to be quite malty, you know, really malty. And that's a lot to do with the combination of the different grains that are used. But ours is a bit lighter than that and it works really, really well in cocktails. And as a shot, I always celebrate it as a Kapstut, which is the traditional kind of you fill up a little Dutch liqueur glass and then put your mouth over it and sling it back and that's your Kapstut chase with a beer. So, yeah, it's a bit of fun and probably a good reflection of what we try and do with our dark series. We're always experimental. We're trying to have, a bit of a laugh sometimes when it comes to the way that we can, you know, create spirit and generate flavour.
And what was the consumer response to, you know, a product like that that's pretty out of the box and takes a lot of explanation and probably a flavour profile that people aren't that used to?
Yeah, it was surprisingly strong. Well, we didn't make much of it. We only made about 800 bottles. So it was never going to be a disaster. Even if we still had that many bottles on shelf, we'd be like, oh, well, it was good fun. But I think off the back of collaborating with someone as strong and as powerful as Sullivan's Cove in the Australian whiskey market, we suddenly saw a lot of collectors purchasing it because whether or not they sort of see the direction that we're on or whether or not they sort of saw it as a limited edition, never to be done again kind of opportunity to pick up a release that's got two different Australian brands on it that are both quite successful in their own right. Whatever that was, you know, we've only got a couple hundred left. So it's certainly been successful in the way that we sort of see these experiments. They're great ways of showcasing what we think when it comes to flavour and the energy of our collaborative partnerships are always really fun things to be able to explore.
And the Dark Series, so is that the same series that Ginash belongs to as well?
Correct. Well, Ginash started off that way. So we usually will always trial a recipe in Dark Series first and that gives us the opportunity to not only sort of see the way that it tracks in market, but give us an opportunity to also adjust the recipe on the fly. Like we're still a really small brand. We don't have the capacity to make up a batch and then not sell it. So if we're trialing recipes on scale and we make 1,000 litres or something, we're not big enough yet just to absorb the cost if we're not happy with the recipe or we need to tweak it or we need to twist it. What Dark Series allows us to do is be able to continue to tweak and twist recipes, be able to perfect the way that we work on recipes. Like Southern Strength started off as a Dark Series. We made 7 different batches of Southern Strength over the course of 7 to 8 months, working alongside Haynes & Co., a beautiful gin bar here in South Australia. And by the time we got to our 7th batch, we knew that we had the right, you know, combination of flavours. We knew that we had exactly the kind of savoury gin style that we wanted to make. And, you know, 2019, it won World's Best Classic Gin. So I think when it comes to those sorts of what the Dark Series is about, it's definitely about trial and error and making our way through, you know, a process of being able to deliver flavour to the utmost degree. And then once we're happy, we either, you know, elevate it to the core range. Some Dark Series will never kind of get to that point because for whatever, like we're still happy with those recipes, but they might be, for example, our Aquavit, which is a really, really fun product. But I don't think the Aquavit market in Australia is really ever going to explode into a raging torrent of products. Who knows? Maybe 10 years' time, we might be all Aquavit drinkers. But in the short term anyway, it's a product that we really love. It goes very well in Australian restaurants. But we'll never sort of hit the core range at any stage because it just doesn't have the volume.
But Ginash, I'm gathering, kind of earned a promotion and probably has you scurrying around trying to get your hands on some more fruit. And Grenache fruit's pretty popular among winemakers these days as well.
Really wish we had picture ads. we didn't picture ads for obvious reasons. You know, Four Pillars do a pretty bloody good job of an incredible representation, and we wanted to carve our own way in the market. Grenache fruit, as you said, is on trend right now, and certainly probably the best representation, I think, of McLaren Vale in terms of that regionality. Grenache fruit here in South Australia are just so diverse in both flavour and usability. For so long, they've been kind of the best. They've just been locked away in blends and very rarely been allowed to kind of play out as their own varietal. But now we're starting to see that more and more. But you're right. We started off last year, 2020, we did our first Grenache release. And it caught fire real quick. We knew it would be popular. Like, it's a delicious product. We make great spirit. But I don't think we really anticipated how quickly we would sell out. We were really hoping to get to 2 months. It kind of went really, really fast, and we were like, okay, we probably should make more than what we did this year. So we got 1 ton of fruit last year. We got 10 tons this year. We were almost sold out of it this year as well. So, you know, again, it's probably an indication of not only the quality of that particular release, but also, I guess, that emerging sort of category here in Australia where there's a lot of people that are really enjoying these fruit gins that are coming out that are reflections of various sort of wine country.
But a long way to get to the size of Four Pillars Bloody Shiraz in scale, because I think they crush over 100 tons of Shiraz.
I'm pretty sure it's over 100 tons. I know that we're trying to get towards 20 this year, which is, you know, not a drop when it comes to what they're doing. I think in their second or third year, I think it was even in their second. Maybe I shouldn't sort of quote out of school because I'm not sure on the statistics, but I know without question they are now the biggest user of Shiraz grapes in their region at the moment. So I dare say that they're doing some serious volume.
Well, if you start doing that with Grenache, then yeah,
everyone's going to hate us. Yeah. we're already begging and pleading for 20 ton, let alone going any harder than that. And I guess that just shows the limitations that some varieties have. But you know, it does create a very, very different fruit gin than what Bloody Shiraz is. I think Shiraz creates a much sort of darker, a lot spicier. There seems to be like a real undercurrent of earthiness, just the same way that you associate those sorts of flavours to the Shiraz varietal. And Grenache, because of its versatility, it's been used all the way through rosé and you know, in a GSM and everything in between, in its own varietal itself can be quite dark. So I think there's a range of different flavours there that can present itself, from bright red currant and raspberry flavours all the way through to sort of tin plum. There's quite a lot of range.
And what is the production methodology you use with it? Is that different to Four Pillars?
It's the same as Four Pillars. There's a few gins on the market that basically reflect the same kind of methodology, and it comes down to trying to integrate that fruit character into the gin as seamlessly as possible. A lot of people think that these wine gins that are coming out, there's like for Grenache, Bloody Shiraz, they're really fruit gins, okay? At no stage has the grape itself been transitioned into a wine. It hasn't been allowed to ferment. It hasn't been finished off. You don't have the same amount of acids and characteristics that you would associate with a finished wine. You don't have the alcohol that a finished wine brings. There are some sort of gins on the market that are that combination where they'll take a gin and they'll take a wine and they'll blend them together to create, you know, that kind of that new wave category. But ours is effectively we take the pressed Grenache fruit and we use it as a dilutive element. So we'll take triple juniper gin off the still at its usual ABV at around about 84-85% ABV. Rather than diluting down with water, we'll put that strong finished gin into pressed Grenache fruit that also contains skins, and we'll let it sit on skin for a couple of weeks. We then press that out after that maturation process has been completed. We'll then separate those skins, we'll press it, and then we'll adjust with a small amount of water to get it to the appropriate ABV that we want to kind of get it at. So that's sort of the process. What you're finding is that it's driven by the fruit character. It's driven by the fruit quality, and it certainly isn't just that process of sort of combining two separate entities together.
The latest product I've seen from you guys is the Oyster Shell Gin, which is certainly something I haven't seen anything quite like before. Tell me about that one.
It's a banger. We were really surprised by it. I first started looking at Oyster Shell Gins in the UK when I was there last time. There's a few kicking about that were quite fun. Were quite fun styles and quite delicious to sample in a martini, and that was always something in the back of my mind. We had done an amazing collaboration with Argo in Hong Kong, where we focused on the martini. We created a dark series that was very much driven by that, and it kind of, I guess, opened up our eyes to the possibility of generating and creating gins specific for restaurants and specific for martinis. And whilst this particular gin, the Oyster Shell Gin, works across a variety of different drink serves, I really, really enjoy it as a martini. Now, oyster shell lends itself to mouthfeel, and obviously when you're making martinis with it, mouthfeel is everything.
Tell me how oyster shell was made. Like, did you collaborate with an oyster farmer or something along those lines?
Yeah, so initially when we decided to create Oyster Shell Gin, it was off the back of our relationship with Society and the Lucas Group in Melbourne. So the Lucas Group have put together some incredible venues like Chin Chin, an amazing kind of, part of Melbourne sort of food culture. Society was going to take it in a slightly different direction, very martini-focused, seafood-focused as well. They've got a really strong seafood offering. So by looking at, I guess, our local oyster providers, we wanted to create a style that was a little bit unique and quite different to anything else in the Australian market. We use oysters from Kangaroo Island. So we just use the shell. We don't actually use the flesh itself.
So it's vegan.
Technically, I guess you could sort of say it. Yeah. We've definitely had a few people reach out asking about it's vegan. I think it's oysters are that grey area, aren't they? They certainly, if you're going to look at the one animal that probably resembles a plant the most, an oyster would probably be a hit. But when it comes to the flavors that we're able to generate with it, oyster shells themselves tend to be actually quite neutral. You don't get an intense amount of sort of, say, oyster flavor out of it. It doesn't smell and taste like an oyster. What you do get out of it is this sort of rich mouthfeel and almost like a minerality, which is quite fun and quite unique and works really well in a martini serve. What we decided to do was really build around that idea of oyster shell and celebrate and support it with seaside ingredients like saltbush, like coastal daisy bush, like Geraldton wax. On the nose, gin is very driven by Geraldton wax. Geraldton wax has a similar kind of aromatic to, say, kaffir lime or lemongrass, has this real bright zestiness to it. And then we add a slight hit of that umami through wakame, Tasmanian wakame. So it is quite a unique style for us. It's still built using our triple juniper base. That's that triple juniper process that I mentioned earlier. It's a part of every single gin that we make. And that's kind of the secret sauce, if you like. A lot of people go, well, you keep winning awards. Like how do you manage that consistency? And it really comes down to the quality of our base gin, of the base flavor profile that we use. It sets us up for success. It contains that wonderful structure. It's a gin with a start, middle, and an end. And then what we do is then we layer flavor on top of that. We do that, through our Argo gin, through our Mediterranean gin, and now through our Oyster Shell gin, and all of them are gold medal winners for that reason.
Now, you guys opened a new cellar door. I mean, it's probably not super recently, but I'd imagine that the trading there has been pretty impacted the last couple of years by COVID. But that must be an important outlet for you to be able to sort of hand sell some of these products that you've talked about that are a little bit left of centre.
That's where we like to do the majority of our work when it comes to engaging people about our Seek More Flavour message. When it comes to the way that food and alcohol tourism, is growing here in Australia, it's wonderful to be this destination space where people turn up after, seeing news articles or listening to podcasts or engaging with us in a in a bar in town, and they hear about some of the weird and wonderful and delicious things that we're able to create. When people sort of walk through the doors at Never Never, we really always hope that they're able to, you know, have this sort of flavor experience, enjoy the various sorts of flights, cocktails, and sampling exercises that we're able to sort of generate on Hill. It was absolutely imperative that we could trade all the way through the year. Even now, with the borders closed or just having opened, to be fair, there still is a lot of hesitancy, and we're still being very well supported, I guess, by locals, which has been incredibly overwhelming, humbling to sort of see that this space that we built as a real tourist destination is still being really driven by not only the local community, but the South Australian community in particular. I can't wait to see what happens when we actually get international guests. Like I remember we opened the doors in March 2020. We closed them 4 weeks later, and I think the borders, international borders, shut at the same time. So here we are, spending huge amounts of money on trying to create this incredible experience, and we felt so passionately that we had done that. But we can't wait to actually share it with the greater wide world as well when people finally start to walk through the custom gates again.
And you're sharing a facility there with Chalk Hill Wines, I think. Actually, we've had Jock on Drinks Adventures podcast talking about his whiskey project, coincidentally. What's been the sort of relationship between Chalk Hill and Never Never?
Oh, they're just incredible. I always get a bit emotional talking about it because they're such incredible sort of individuals, humans, to be able to kind of see what we were able to create as a business. I still remember when we were looking for a site in McLaren Vale, and we got a lot of shut doors in our faces, like not many people particularly want to share a residence or share, their production facilities with another brand. Sure, we're a gin brand. We don't particularly compete, but a lot of people just didn't see the necessity or see the need or want to have us on site. And the Harpies were the complete opposite. They sort of saw us as this opportunity to partner with them to create an amazing food and drink destination, where they can combine, where we could combine forces. We sort of cover off on the cocktails and the gin, and they cover off an incredible award-winning wine. And as a duo, I feel like we're really, really complementary in the way that we're able to work together. But yeah, it's like we've originally, the first dark series of Grenache, we actually used Grenache fruit from the Harvey's family plot, So we're calling out John and Di Harvey, who are the landowners. They're the matriarch, if you like, the patriarch of the family. And like we've always had a very strong connection and relationship, I guess, with those guys as well. So we've been very lucky. We've been very, very lucky to be able to work alongside them. They're, multi-generational wine growers in the region, and they certainly have given us a real insight and into how to work and be a part of the community there.
Now, you picked up another award in recent weeks, the Premier's Export Award or Premier's Food and Beverage Industry Awards. I saw in the blurb that you're in 6 export markets. How's that going for you guys?
Oh, look, trying to export anything in the time of COVID is pretty tough, I have to admit. But it's an incredible honour, to receive that. It's we could always be doing more from an export perspective. We really built our brand to be something that could be exported. We wanted it to be something that was a reflection of the Australian, gin industry, something that could be taken proudly overseas and compete against London Dries all around the world. And that was a real focus for us too. One of the biggest challenges, I guess, when you're creating a gin style that celebrates an Indigenous flavour or a local flavour where there's a lot of understanding about that flavour locally, it becomes harder and harder the further you get away from that centre, the further you move away from that understanding. Trying to convince someone in Germany about a finger lime is tough, it requires a lot of education, it requires a lot of resourcing. When juniper is your focus, it's obviously more widely understood, and those flavors are popular in bars from Tokyo to you know, Wellington to, you know, Singapore, all the way through Europe, you know, obviously into London. So our gin style itself was always set up as a gin that would excite and engage globally, not just here locally. And we feel like we've done a really good job of that.
Yeah, I imagine that positioning is a double-edged sword, though, as well, because you also don't have that point of difference that we kind of talked about earlier.
Yeah, but the thing that we've always tried to do is flavour is our point of difference, and it's hard, right, because, you know, it's always going to be a challenge. Like, take our Juniper Freak, for example. Like, the more we push Juniper Freak, the more I realise that it's very, very special. There's not anything globally that does what Juniper Freak does. Especially in the UK, the way that people have picked up and started to run with that particular product, because it does separate itself from the rest of the pack in terms of its intensity, the fact that it looshes when it's diluted, not just a little bit, but almost, you know, aggressively due to the juniper oils and the citrus oils that can be found in there. It's an absolute flavor bomb. And when you put that up against other products, it doesn't matter where they're from, like, people want it. You know, it's a reflection of everything that's delicious about the gin category dialed up to 20. And that for me, I think, is the real sort of separation or the point of difference. But it all comes down to, you know, tasting and trial and being in market and being able to support it in lots of different ways. And that's probably been the biggest challenge. Like, I can't wait to get back to London and pour some Juniper Freak down people's mouths at Juniperlooza and all the various festivals that, you know, are great ways for people to actually engage with our products. But so far it's just been a challenge to even get to New South Wales, let alone fly internationally.
Your packaging's really unique as well. What was the inspiration for that design?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of, I spent enough time at Diageo to probably be aware of the importance of marketing and being slightly different on shelf. I didn't want to just be another short bottle with a white label, you know, and there's lots of examples of that kind of style and influence in the Australian market. And I think from the outset, we wanted to have something that was different and looked different and looked exciting and had colour. Customers always connect with colour before they connect with and shape before they connect with anything to do with words on a back bar, especially if it's something that's unfamiliar. So I wanted something with height and with colour, with a unique label. And for those reasons, we started to sort of head down this road of having this sort of triangular label in a tall bottle. I didn't really think about the way that the bottles would be used afterwards, which has been a really incredible kind of response. Watching the amount of bars that use our bottles as a syrup bottle, as a juice bottle, you know, has been great. We're actually upgrading our bottles in the next couple of months to have graduations down the back of it for the purposes of things like stock taking and for actually syrup batching. And we've just found that there's a second, rather than sort of just your bottles ending up in the bin, a lot of ours tend to be recycled and reused in venue for those purposes, which has been great to see.
Fantastic, mate. Well, I reckon we might leave it there. So congratulations on all of your recent awards. Amazing achievements.
Thanks so much.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at by James Atkinson. Like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.